Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll learn more about a theater special effects company in Louisville. First, Kentucky Education Commissioner John Drought believes he's finally quieted questions surrounding his request for a fully loaded state car. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has the story.
State Education Commissioner John Drought recently approved the purchase of an $18,000 Chrysler automobile with $13,000 in extras, including a V8 engine, a hands-free telephone, and a global positioning system. Other education officials who are issued state cars drive Chevrolets, valued at around $16,000. Drought later denied knowing anything about the cost of the car until shown emails obtained by the Louisville Courier-Journal that proved otherwise.
I made some comment that I did not recall the cost, and the truth of the matter is I did not recall the cost. Now, I did approve it and should have known the cost, but at the time I told you that, I did not know the cost.
The purchase drew immediate criticism from State School Board Chairman Joe Brothers, who said it sends the wrong signal in tight budget times. After meeting privately with Brothers and several school board members Wednesday, Drought publicly apologized for using, quote, bad judgment.
The timing certainly was not good at all with all the problems we have with budgeting. And from my point of view, if I had that to do over again, I would have done it differently.
In later comments to reporters, Drought again apologized to the people of the Commonwealth and explained why he wanted the add-ons.
I requested the GPS and the hands-free phone because of what I felt was a need for safety issues, and I still feel that way.
But Drought's apology apparently was not enough. Chairman Brothers made it clear the issue was not totally resolved, and the board would further discuss the matter in closed session.
You know, this really, we'd like to see the commissioner come forth with a solution for us, and he's thinking about what he might do, what is the best way to get past this and make it, as I believe he said, right with everybody involved.
Is his job in jeopardy?
No.
What did board members think about the issue? Opinions varied. Steve Neal of Louisville had some questions, but seemed to think the entire matter was somewhat overblown.
I said to the chair that I kind of think we're in the thick of something thin here. I think there's far more important things for us to be doing than focusing on a car.
Dory Combs of Richmond was asked if Drought should return the car.
I'm not ready to go there yet, okay? I think that there are different options, and I think the board needs to look at it, and I think we need to see what he's going to say.
The answer came later in the day when Drought suddenly announced he would reimburse the state for any additional costs associated with the car's purchase.
I'm going to pay for any loss of funds that the state has. For example, I might decide to buy the car. You know, I don't know the cost. You know, there are several options here, perhaps, other than just paying $13,000. That may be the final way it'll be resolved. But from what I understand, I could buy the car. I don't know if I want a car yet. I need a little time to evaluate it, you know, and to think about it.
Drought's decision seemed to appease the board and Chairman Brothers, who canceled the closed session.
He's taking care of it, and he's doing a great job of getting out there and making the connections around the state to promote kids and education, and so we just want him to continue to do that.
Asked if he believes the matter is now closed, Commissioner Drought said, quote, as far as I'm concerned, it is. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
In what's often called the horse capital of the world, thoroughbred racing is king. Kentucky's equine legacy is, and always will be, in racing. But on one farm in Oldham County, a motley crew of Mustangs, a draft horse, a miniature, and a donkey are taking steps to make the future a little brighter for Louisville's troubled youth. Stephanie Sanders reports.
They're kids who've likely spent their youth being shuttled around various foster homes and in unending group therapy sessions, and now they're finding roots, and maybe a little bit of themselves, in the unexpected friendship of a horse. It takes about 30 minutes to get to Esperanza Farm from downtown Louisville, and just enough twisty turns to consider yourself far removed from whatever you left behind there. Esperanza is the home of Forward Motion, an equine therapy company run by Margaret LaRocca. Her therapists are a motley crew of Mustangs, a draft horse, a miniature, and a donkey named Lanella.
Who is this?
This is Bella. She's standing in the shade with her, trying to stay cool. Right, Bella?
I don't blame you, girl. LaRocca equates equine-assisted psychotherapy to the more well-known talk therapy. You know, the one with the shrink and the couch. But in this case, the shrink is a horse.
Horses do one very magical thing that they really force you to be in the moment. I mean, when you're in here with three young Mustangs that are running around and playing and interacting with each other, they bring you in the moment. And oftentimes our clients are either living in the past or anticipating the future. And so being in this setting kind of brings them into a mindfulness state. So it's very therapeutic.
There's actually very little riding that goes on during these sessions. Much of the work is done in observing the horses and how they interact with each other. She asks each person to choose which horse is most like them and why. And that's where she can learn a lot about the client. Instead of a teenager telling her they're insecure, which would be very difficult to get them to verbalize, they're telling her the gray horse is most like them because its head is down and it never perks up its ears. The scene takes the pressure off the child and puts it on the horse. The social services agency Boys Haven recently started sending their abused and sometimes homeless boys to Esperanza for therapy sessions, and they aren't the only ones. The Equine Assisted Growth and Learning Association, which certifies the therapists, now has more than 60 training sessions, and thousands of new equine therapists are joining the ranks each year. Boys Haven Executive Director Vern Rickert says the program has exceeded his expectations.
Four of the kids wanted to volunteer out there. Well, we, you know, kids, they hardly ever want to volunteer to do any kind of work. So that's just an example of how it's kind of taken root with some of these kids.
One of LaRocca's most memorable clients from Boys Haven is a young man who identified most with Big Jim, a draft horse who stands 6 feet tall and is clearly the largest of the pack.
He would run around this field chasing that horse, calling it names, screaming at it, and it was hard to watch. The fourth session, he got out of the van and he said, "Where is Jim's halter?" He goes, "You know, I have been thinking about this and I've decided I'm going to change my approach." He went out into the field and within 10 minutes, he had gotten Jim. He came up to me and he said, "I just want to let you know that I'm going to be going to a foster home." And I realized that I'm Big Jim and that I don't like to be caught, and that I realize that my approach in coming up to people is always that of control and pressure, and he didn't want that. And so today I approached him as a friend and I dropped that, and he said, "I'm always going to remember what Jim taught me."
For WFPL, I'm Stephanie Sanders.
You can see and hear Big Jim and his colleagues at Esperanza Farm in a few videos on our website, WFPL.org. Special effects are widespread in all kinds of entertainment, including the theater. Elizabeth Kramer takes a peek behind the curtain to find out why special effects are on the rise.
At a rehearsal on the Iroquois Amphitheater stage, Stu Cox is showing two cast members of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory how to fly. Cox works for ZFX. The company equips and trains cast and crew members of productions around the world. Cox is outfitting Connor Holloway and Eddie Lewis with harnesses. They play Charlie and Grandpa Joe. They have hinges affixed to their hips and attached to cables that are attached to a hoisting system above the stage.
So we're going to lift up just a little bit off the ground. Mm-hmm. First of all, just see if it feels right to him, feels like it's in the right spot.
Cox instructs the two actors to do handstands and flips. The moves are in a scene where Charlie and Grandpa Joe drink a brew that allows them to fly. At the same time, these actors are trying to sing with the orchestra. Flying as spectacle is a ZFX specialty, not only on this stage, but on others around the world. It oversees the flying equipment and training for all of the productions of Wicked, including one that opens next month in Australia, and for productions at community and regional theaters. ZFX, founded in California in 1994, moved to Louisville in 2006, in part to grow in a place where land is cheaper and to reduce freight costs to East Coast productions. The staff has nearly quadrupled to meet demand. That growth parallels that of other companies providing the needed technologies for theatrical special effects, says David Barber. Barber is editor-in-chief at Lighting and Sound America, a publication that covers the technology behind the entertainment industry.
There is certainly a trend, particularly in the shows that are aimed at younger people, to have a lot of special effects, flying and transformations and scenic effects of that sort. They tend to be fantasy shows.
Barber credits shows produced by Disney with harnessing modern technology and raising audiences' expectations for special effects. He says technology has completely transformed theater over the past 20 years by incorporating automated lighting, where lights can be pre-programmed to pan, tilt, and change color quickly, and digital audio, which provides a sense of immediacy to the action. Most recently, projection technology has allowed theater designers to saturate stages with realistic and even improbable scenes. Barber says theater and other performing arts are using these technologies to attract new and young audiences. He says companies like ZFX are thriving because many producers want to create a unique experience and because entertainment now infuses everything in our culture, from corporate to religious life. ZFX's productivity is evident in its burgeoning complex of buildings just south of downtown Louisville. Here, employees weld equipment for rigging systems, and there are costume shops and a nearly 5,000 square foot studio where ZFX works with performers. Co-owner Terry Kirsch says 50% of the company's business comes from regional theaters, while the rest is split between major long-running musicals and performances mounted by cruise lines, churches, and increasingly major corporations like BMW and Cisco Systems. Kirsch says there is potential for more growth there.
A lot of the marketing we're doing right now is in the corporate industry. You have a CEO of a company that wants to make an impact or a reveal of a new product they have. So at their sales conference, they fly in and they reveal their new product and the sales team or the salespeople go crazy because that's a big hype. They want to hype up the salespeople.
Still, ZFX continues to bank on projects destined for Broadway. The latest is Angels, a musical loosely based on Milton's Paradise Lost. For that show, ZFX created computer programs that use joysticks to support five people in the air at once. They filmed a scene for the producers.
That particular project encompasses the entire gamut of what we do. If you push a button and everybody flies, all the cues are already set.
The video helped the producers secure $17 million from investors, and that kind of investment trickles down to ZFX, which is expected to exceed $10 million in sales by 2012, and to the regional economy. While Barber says businesses serving the entertainment industry don't usually have high profit margins, he doesn't see any decline in the demand for live entertainment with special effects, especially if those businesses continue to invent new ways to dazzle us. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
I'm flying, I'm flying. There's no sensation that's quite as sensational as flying. Thrilling, fulfilling, and higher educational as flying. It's inspirational and recreational.
The states of Ohio and Kentucky have come to verbal blows over a rock. Subpoenas have been issued, threats hurled across the water, and meanwhile, the 8-ton rock waits in a municipal warehouse in Portsmouth, Ohio, for officials to determine its fate. Kristen Espelon has the story in five scenes of Indian Head Rock.
Scene 1, October 1891. Indian Head Rock is submerged in the Ohio River.
A reporter from the Portsmouth Times in Ohio is watching two men row a skiff across the river toward Kentucky. They're searching for signs of a sunken rock, a rock with historic carvings. Mostly the carvings are a kind of vintage graffiti, initials and names and dates, likely the work of early European arrivals to the area when the river was low enough. But locals like the Portsmouth Times reporter know that one carving on the rock looks like a primitive face, basically a ring with two holes for eyes and two half circles for ears.
What is the story of the Indian Head? Like all stories that run back into tradition, it has been painted in various colors during the years. The boy idea of it has always been that it was the work of Indians.
But there is nothing in the features to indicate that they might not just as well have been those of a white man.
And so the legend grew. But the river continued to rise after it was dammed, and the rock lay somewhat forgotten at the bottom of the murky, busy river.
Scene 2. More than 100 years later. Amateur historian Stephen Schaefer decides to go looking for the rock.
Schaefer, who is an upholsterer by trade, read about the rock as a boy. Years later, rock carvings still fascinate him, and he wants to make a documentary.
This Indian said that one was the one that just really fascinated me. And I thought, at that time it would be a great thing to discover that and maybe put that as part of the documentary.
The documentary was never made, but after a 3-year search, Schaefer and fellow divers find the rock and leave it. And that's that. Until Schaefer meets some search and rescue divers from Portsmouth.
I asked them, I said, hey, would you like to go over and see the Indian's Head? And they'd never heard of it. And they dove on. They said, wow, did you see those names? Those are Portsmouth names. Did you ever think about getting this up?
Portsmouth last names of people Schaefer actually knows. So last September, Schaefer and the divers managed to raise the 8-ton rock with inflatable bags and hoist it onto a boat with a crane.
Scene 3. The trouble begins.
They bring it to a city warehouse where the mayor celebrates its arrival.
It's a criminal action in criminal court.
Across the river, Kentucky County Attorney Cliff Duval says Indian Head Rock is protected under Kentucky's antiquities law, that it was in Kentucky waters, not Ohio's.
And there are Class D felony penalties for damaging or removing objects of antiquity without the knowledge and approval of the proper authorities in Kentucky.
So Duval sues two Portsmouth residents, likely Steve Schaefer and the mayor of Portsmouth, though Duval won't say. He'd like to see them in a Kentucky court and ask for restitution of the rock. But it's not as simple as that. An Ohio judge has to order them to cross state lines. And a hearing has been set for June 24th. Duval insists this isn't about a border war.
The issue is not ownership of the rock. It's not who's going to be able to gawk at it in some museum, or whether the Ohioans get it and beat the Kentuckians or vice versa. It's about all antiquities.
Scene 4. The politicians get involved.
The Kentucky Native American Heritage Commission sponsors a resolution in the State House of Representatives condemning what it calls the illegal removal of the rock. The accusations begin to fly. Newspaper articles are churned out. Commissioner and representative from Louisville, Reginald Meeks, says the media, present company excluded, misattributes a quote to him, a rabble-rousing quote from the House floor during debate about the rock. He clarifies.
It was an off-the-cuff, spontaneous comment by the Speaker of the House who indicated that he was ready to go raid if I was ready to lead. And I indicated that I was ready to lead if he was ready to follow.
But Meeks calls the idea of an actual raiding party to reclaim the rock nonsensical. On the other side of the Ohio, state representative from Portsmouth, Todd Book, files his own resolution, calling on Kentucky to relinquish any claim to the rock, calling it inextricably linked to the city of Portsmouth, Ohio. He organizes an essay contest for fourth graders who must write about why the rock belongs in Portsmouth. The essay contest goes national. It's called Rock This Essay. There's even a video.
A big disgrace, you chiseled your name with a house in the face. Scene 5. Not quite the end.
Steve Schaefer thinks the rock should stay put.
I think the rock should stay in Portsmouth. They're willing to keep it in a climate-controlled facility and take very good care of it.
Representative Meek says the damage is already done.
It should never have been removed because the river was providing all the protection that it needed in order to preserve it for future generations.
True, future generations would probably need to be certified divers and feel very at home in low-visibility waters. And of course, stones in water can erode eventually. But where the rock can be seen and studied next is for the court to decide. For WFPL, I'm Kristen Espeland. The end.
You can watch the We Will Rock You video on our website at WFPL.org. When we come back, we'll learn more about a new book detailing the lives of Tennessee Ernie Ford and his wife, Betty. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, Robin Fisher talks with grilling guru Steve Reichlin. First, Tennessee Ernie Ford is considered one of the pioneers of American entertainment in the television age. In addition to his groundbreaking work as a TV host in the 1950s, Ford, born Ernest Jennings Ford, was a successful recording artist in multiple genres, including country and western, pop and gospel. Ford recorded what would become his signature tune, 16 Tons, in 1955. It rocketed to the top of the country and pop charts and made Ford a household name. He died in 1991. Now, Jeffrey Ford, the eldest son of Tennessee Ernie and Betty Ford, has written a memoir about his parents called River of No Return, Tennessee Ernie Ford and the Woman He Loved. In it, he recalls what it was like to grow up with his celebrated father and the trials that accompanied the fame and fortune, including both parents' battle with alcoholism. Jeffrey Ford spoke to us from his home in Nashville. Let me ask you to start, when did you realize that your father was Tennessee Ernie Ford, the famous guy?
Good question. You grow up in your home, and you have those earliest impressions of your mother and father, and I think that for me, the earliest impression that I had that Dad did something that resulted in a lot of people being aware of who he was. Was actually an impression that I gleaned from the big Magnavox in the living room in our house in Monterey Park. It was the one room in the house I could go to where I knew I could see my dad. In those early years, he was on the road a great deal and in the studio a great deal. And I don't remember him being a living, breathing man in the house. I remember seeing him in the television, when he would come home, and we'd go to the hardware store, or we'd go out to dinner or whatever, there was a tremendous number of people that I believed were his friends. And I recall being stricken early on with the fact that whatever my dad did, and singing seemed to be a part of it, and just talking to people seemed to be a part of it, generated a tremendous number of personal friends, and I thought, wait, this might be a lot of work, you know, as I grew older that I might like to get into, and so it was an early age when I realized that he did something that affected people.
Now, how old were you when the 16 Tons hit it big?
I was 5 years old. 16 Tons was released October 17th of 1955, obviously, it changed everything for us as a family, but the truth of the matter is that it changed a great many things for a great many people. The song was originally written by Merle Travis in 1946 and came quickly under the investigative eyes of the FBI, as Travis himself had, because the song bespoke the plight of the working man at a time when unionization in the country was being perceived as being seditious, communist influenced, mm-hmm. and like that. And because of that, and a couple of other songs Merle Travis had written that took the management or government to task in many ways, the song was investigated. And when it eventually laid fallow until 55 and was recorded again, Ernie Ford was investigated.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
The song struck a chord in the hearts, the minds, and the spirits of the working class. It spoke about the plight of miners, but it could have been speaking about the plight of plumbers, or the plight of other construction workers, or the plight of dock workers, at a time when many people, many thousands of blue-collar workers in America owed their soul to the company store. And the company store might have been on the dock, it might have been in the middle of town, it might have been on a mine camp in Hazard County, Kentucky. And that didn't set well with a lot of people, and that kind of rallying cry for the worker. And it resulted in the song becoming more controversial and really, really bearing a tremendous amount of meaning for the common American folks.
I'm curious how your dad got the moniker Tennessee Ernie Ford.
Well, that's a good story too, and it was part and parcel of the effect, and I guess you could say template for a lot of radio shows and radio hosts in the day, and in Southern California, when that moniker first was used, there were a number of disc jockeys who had nicknames for themselves. One of them was the Squeakin' Deacon, and Cliffy Stone was actually Clifford Snyder. And at that time, Ernest Ford, as a radio announcer, had already begun splitting his personality. He, for the news, was a very erudite, very clear and concise, had wonderful tones to his voice, and he was Ernest Jennings Ford, bringing you the news from the studios of KFXM or KXLA. For his entertainment aspect on the show, he felt that he needed to separate the two personas, and he developed this character, who didn't have a last name. He was just Tennessee Ernie. And he built an entire radio, I guess you could say, experience around this character. He developed a show called Bar Nothing Ranch. And he had brought cowbells into the studio, brought sound effects, and developed a 30-minute music program centered in an imaginary bunkhouse where you could come in and eat some great home-cooked food and listen to the latest and the greatest on a hit parade. And the foreman of the place, if you will, was this crazed hillbilly named Tennessee Ernie. For many years, nobody made the connection. Nobody knew that it was the same person. Hmm. It was all born out of theater.
Well, of course, he became a major star. Turn to the book, River of No Return, Tennessee Ernie Ford and the Woman He Loved. This is really the story of your father and mother.
Yes, sir.
How did they handle the fame?
In some ways, well. In other ways, not as well as they could have. But hindsight is always 20/20. This story of their lives is not just a story about how well they handled the fame, but how the fame affected each of us in the family. Mom and Dad, for all practical purposes, were two very ordinary people, Betty Ford and Ernie Ford. The story is about how those two ordinary people were changed forever by an extraordinary life that towards the end they lost control over. They lost the ability to control their own destinies and their own lives, and it's really a story of how that affected them and how the changes that they experienced affected us all as a family.
And your father did at one point try to walk away from the fame and the fame and fortune?
He did. He towards the early part of the 1960s, the Ford Show in its last 2 years on NBC was the highest-rated variety show in the country. It was the number one half-hour variety show and on all three networks, and was the only show of its kind to ever unseat Playhouse 90. It really was a watershed live television show and set the tone and stage for a number of other shows of that ilk that followed. By the 60 and 61 season, however, Dad was really beginning to feel that they had run the race. They had run, they had taken this show and the bits and the writing and the great fun that it was as far as they could take it. He was frankly getting tired of the sameness. He wanted to go out on top. He didn't want to see the ratings begin to plummet. And wanted to open that door and take that step away before it became too much like work. Ernie Ford loved what he did, but when something really began to become work, he started looking for something else, you know. When he and his agents, actually, from MCA and under Lou Wasserman, when they notified Ford Motor Company and J. Walter Thompson, its advertising agency, that he was going to retire after the fifth season, there was a point in time where literally the most powerful people in advertising and in television offered him anything. He was already the highest paid primetime entertainer in the business, and they offered him whatever he wanted if he would simply stay in Hollywood and continue with the Ford show. Dad declined, and there was a tremendous shockwave in Hollywood when that happened. And he was very plain. He told them all he was retiring from series television, and indeed we were moving to the Bay Area where Mom and Dad had built a house. What he hadn't told NBC and J. Walter Thompson and Ford Motor Company, however, was that he had secretly accepted a deal with ABC.
Oh.
And it was the single biggest contract that ABC had ever given to a performer. And we completed our move to the Bay Area, and Dad began a wonderful three-year daily series from San Francisco on ABC. When that show closed, Dad did leave series television. But he left kind of an earthquake, in his wake. It's a great story.
We're talking with Jeffrey Buckner Ford, the author of River of No Return, about his mom and dad, Tennessee Ernie Ford, and the woman he loved. You're very frank in the book about there was alcohol abuse and so forth in the home, and you have a brother as well, correct?
Yes, sir. I do. I have a younger brother, Brian Ford. He lives in White House, Tennessee, just a little bit north of Nashville.
How did all this affect you and your brother?
Well, growing up, Brian and I were very, very close. We had all the normal problems that every pair of brothers has in their lives. But growing up, we were very close. We experienced a wonderful childhood together because of the great privilege that Dad's career gave us as a family. As events unfolded in these later years following Mom's passing in 1989, things changed, however, and it's a very disappointing and saddening thing for me, but as things changed, lives changed, since Dad's passing in 91 and events that have unfolded since then surrounding the family, the relationship that I've had with Brian has unfortunately become strained, and we are not as close as we used to be.
Hmm. Now, your mother passed away first, correct?
Mom passed away February 26th of 89. Dad remarried just a few short months after to a person that had been actually a close friend of the family's for about 25 years. And Dad's health, however, was very tenuous at that point in time. And uh, He died October 17th of 1991, a little more than a year after he had remarried. And that date, by the way, of October 17th of 91, Dad passed away 36 years to the day after the release of 16 Tons.
Hmm. What motivated you to write this book, and why at this point?
Well, I actually began the first chapters of this book in 1979, right after the birth of our first son, Patrick. The truth of the matter is, though, that I was really not nearly prepared enough or mature enough as a writer, nor was I prepared or mature enough as a husband or a father or a son to devote the kind of discipline and effort that needed to be made to properly write a book of this scope. Mom and Dad were also both alive then, and although we didn't know it, there was a significant group of chapters of their lives that had yet to be played out. And as reality has a way of insinuating itself in our lives, I really wanted to be a writer, but the want of the thing did not match up with the work that was involved, and it would be 20 years before I would finally find the discipline as a writer, and had time to hone any kind of skill or craft that I might have today. As a writer, I was also very busy as an actor then, doing a number of feature films and television shows, and the work literally supplanted what I viewed at any rate as a joy to write. I didn't have the time, didn't have the skill, didn't have the discipline. When I finally sat down. And after taking some classes in writing and tutoring myself and reading every volume of every memoir I could possibly get my hands on, I realized in one evening that the book that I had been trying to write about my own life was not what needed to be written at all, but rather the book that needed to be written was the story of the lives of these two people. And that, once I realized how to do the task, it became a matter of 6 to 10 hours a day, nonstop for 2 years until River of No Return was sitting in front of me.
Well, your father remains enormously popular. What's the response been from his fans?
It has been nothing short of incredible. We have been overwhelmed by the number of people that have commented, written to say that they'd purchased the book The response has been also been nothing short of positive, each to the letter. We've not received anything less than glowing reviews, and that's been a humbling thing. When I was in Los Angeles last week for Book Expo America, which is the largest publishing and book convention in the world, my signing session for the book was scheduled for a Sunday morning, the last morning of the convention. And obviously, a lot of us were kind of worried, you know, for an autograph session on a Sunday morning after a Saturday night at a convention, you know, there's all kinds of pink elephants walking around. And we were blown away, literally blown away by, in that 1 hour that you have reserved for signing session, we signed 165 books in that 1 hour.
Wow.
It was astonishing. And we thought also in retrospect that it was indicative of a very broad base of fans who hopefully will go out and buy the book.
Well, the name of the book is River of No Return, Tennessee Ernie Ford and the Woman He Loved, and the author is Mr. Ford's son, Jeffrey Buckner Ford. Jeffrey, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, buddy, I appreciate it very much, and my very best to everybody listening out there, and we want to thank you so much for giving us this opportunity.
More information about Tennessee Ernie Ford and Jeffrey Ford's memoirs available at our website, wfpl.org.
Now we're like a double bind. Got to keep a-clinging to me all the time. Early in the evening when the sun goes down by the weeping willow tree. Get a sweet little fence from a sweet little miss on Sunday down in Tennessee. Oh, baby, take me by the hand and lead me to the promised land. My owls are like honeysuckle vines. Got to keep a-clinging to me all the time. Early in the evening when the sun goes down by the weeping willow tree. I get a sweet little kiss from a sweet little miss. Sunday down in Tennessee.
Oh, brother.
Oh, the walk back, I'll put my head up high. Look that parson right in the eye. Shout hallelujah till the day I die. On Sunday,
Sunday, Sunday down in Tennessee.
We get tips for that Father's Day barbecue when we come back. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Do you grill or barbecue? Maybe you've got a Father's Day grill out scheduled. Well, according to grilling guru Stephen Reichland, success depends on the method more than the equipment. Reichland has just released an updated version of his award-winning The Barbecue Bible, and he took some time on the road to talk with Robin Fisher about grilling, barbecuing, and cooking over wood.
I got a laugh when I started reading the section in your book on the difference between grilling and barbecuing, because it seems like everybody has a different definition. I grill, and when I grill, it's when I'm cooking over fire. And then barbecue, to me, is something with a sauce. I have a friend from Canada, and when they're cooking with fire, they are cooking on the barbecue.
Yeah, they're really kind of five meanings to the word barbecue, and one refers to a piece of equipment, this barbecue grill. That was the original meaning. A barbecue comes from barbacoa, which was the Taino Indian word for a wooden grill that you could position over a smoky fire to preserve meat. But barbecue also refers to a technique, and that is cooking foods over a low fire slowly in the presence of a lot of wood smoke. Barbecue also refers to some specific foods cooked that way. For example, if you ask somebody in North Carolina what's barbecue, they're going to tell you pulled pork. If you ask the same question to someone in Kansas City, they're going to say spare ribs. Someone from Texas will say brisket. Someone from Santa Maria, California will say tri-tip. So that's kind of the third definition. Fourth definition is a meal cooked outdoors. And finally, barbecue also means it's a kind of a communal feast. It's a communal feast eaten outdoors.
Well, you know, one thing that I thought was interesting in reading the first part was you talk about how grilling or barbecuing and cooking over a fire has sort of had a resurgence in the past 10 years, and yet it takes us back to the beginning.
Well, it really does, and I've done quite a bit of research on the history of barbecue and the history of human evolution. And if you look at fossil skulls of our ancestors about the time when we have the first evidence of the use of fire to cook meat, which was about 500,000 years ago, within 100,000 years, you see a very dramatic change, and you see a skull that goes from being more ape-like back in the days before fire to skull recognizable by modern men. You know, the act of eating meat grilled over fire really had a profound influence on human evolution.
And, you know, speaking of meat being cooked over an open fire, your cookbook, The Barbecue Bible, is not your grandpa's cookbook. I mean, there are recipes in here that they're from all over the world.
Well, that's the premise of the book, really. It starts with the idea that that live fire cooking is popular everywhere, grilling is popular everywhere, but people do it differently in every country. So I set about on a 3-year odyssey to travel the world's barbecue trail and learn what was similar in each country and what was different in each country. And I think the similarity is the passion for grilled foods, but, you know, the dish, sauces, the condiments are very different as you travel around the world.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot of fun doing your travels.
Yeah, fun. Yeah, it was a fantastic experience.
Tell us about the recipes in the book. We just talked about sort of they come from all over the world, but are there not just main dish recipes. There are drinks as well as side dishes. And it seems to me that there's a recipe in here for every level.
Well, I'm glad you picked that up. I mean, first of all, sort of our motto at Barbecue University and on the Primal Grill TV show is the whole meal in the grill. So absolutely, the appetizers, grilled salads, even grilled desserts. In terms of level of difficulty, that is also reflected in how the world grills. In some parts of the world, like particularly in Texas and Argentina, you know, the condiments for grilling are a little more, the flavorings for grilling are a little more than salt and pepper and fire. On the other hand, in places like India and Indonesia, the spicing becomes really extravagant. In India, there's a very elaborate tradition of grilled bread. So you can really approach this as simply or as intricately as you would like to.
Where would you suggest someone start with a book? Should they start in the beginning?
Well, you know what? If you're a newcomer to the world of grilling, or even if you want a sort of refresher course, the first 50 pages are what I call my crash course on the art of barbecuing and grilling. Covers all the different types of grills, the different types of fuels, the five methods of live fire cooking, how to light a charcoal grill safely, how to light a gas grill safely. And then we get sort of into particular foods, the way to cook a perfect steak, the way to cook perfect ribs, sort of all those iconic foods. So a lot of people use the book and read the book that way. Other people like to just sort of thumb through it. Workman books are always sort of visually very provocative and stimulating, and you know, you open a page and there's a box that sort of leads you to another page and another idea, and that's equally legitimate.
Now, this is an
sort of like night table reading for guys.
Now, this is an updated edition. So, what's different?
It is. Well, the first thing we did is, you know, our world is so visual. So, we put 100 color photographs in the book, and those photographs, A, show you how to do it, and B, show you what it should look like. So if you've always wanted to make a Thai grilled beef salad or Memphis-style ribs, you can look at the picture and know kind of what your destination is. The second thing we did with this crash course on barbecuing and grilling, for the last couple of years we've been collecting the frequently asked questions on my website, barbecuebible.com, and we sort of built that chapter around those questions and on the premise that if, you know, six people ask on the internet, there are probably 600 who are wondering the same thing. The third thing that's different is actually that foods have changed since the first Barbecue Bible came out. And the most striking example would probably be something like the baby back rib. When I wrote Barbecue Bible, the most common baby back rib was a rib from Denmark that weighed about a pound. Well, in the supersizing of America, the average baby back now weighs about 2 to 2.5 pounds. So, you know, we needed to adjust the recipes and the yields accordingly.
So let me ask you the age-old debate in the grilling world.
Charcoal versus gas.
Right.
Neither.
What
neither. I'm a big fan of grilling over wood. For me, grilling over wood both gives you... It gives you the heat profile of charcoal. It gives you, you know, the added flavor of wood smoke, but it's not quite as heavy as the smoking in true barbecue. However, if you can't grill over wood, the second best compromise is to buy both a charcoal grill and a gas grill. This is actually a trend that's been observed by in watchers. Roughly a third of American families own more than one grill these days.
Well, Stephen, thank you very much for your time.
The pleasure is mine, and thank you.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with author and master griller Stephen Reichlin. He's just released an updated version of his award-winning The Barbecue Bible and will be signing copies at Barnes & Noble at the Summit Saturday evening at 7. And as always, there's more information on our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 800-306-4202, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at LPM, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.